Welcome to episode 55 of Blues and Barnacles, a podcast which relates to all things relating to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Dermot.
And I'm Kelly. Well, I think we've got a really good podcast today. I think we're really going to get into some issues. And I think we might find out some surprising facts along the way.
Mm. We learned something about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. The real Ulysses is the friends we made along the way.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you're just joining us for the first time.
God help you.
Dermot is our artist, and he always does a wonderful illustration for each podcast episode, which you can see where?
On our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com.
That's right. And Dermot is going to tell us a little bit about his drawing for this week's episode.
Yeah, it's James Joyce himself doing a nice little strut down the street with sexy red high heels.
Mm-hmm.
I forget why. I don't know what the... It's been a while since I drew that one.
Okay, I was going to ask you why you drew James Joyce instead of Stephen Dedalus, but I'm going to go ahead and assume you don't remember that either.
I don't. James Joyce is more fun to draw anyway.
Why is that?
He's got a big bean head.
Why couldn't Stephen have a bean head?
He could, but I don't draw him like that. And it would confuse people. I want him to be a little different because there's too much overlap between Dedalus and Joyce anyway. So visually, I need him to look like they're not the same person.
What's your visual marker for Stephen Dedalus?
He's not younger, but scrawnier. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have a huge chin.
He suffers from inanition. That's the word he used for malnourishment.
You get three Hail Marys and the four Our Fathers for doing that in confession.
Before we get into our passage for today, we want to drop in a couple of shout-outs here. First of all, if you hear something that you like or maybe even don't like in our podcast, or you have questions or comments or theories of your own, you can drop us an email. We got a number of emails this week. Oh, where can people email us?
At bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Yes, you can find our email address there. If you're looking for a more direct route, our address is bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com.
Okay.
And so I had a treasure trove of letters to choose from this week, but I decided to go with the most effusive and gushing of them. And this is from a listener named Eva. So I'd like Dermot to read that.
Yeah. Eva made Kelly's day with this one. I just felt like I should send you an email to thank you for how helpful your blog has been in these times for me. I'm from Limerick and I'm doing Ulysses for my final year thesis. Your blog has been the best thing that's ever happened to me in my study, as I already love the book, but your podcast and blog actually make me enjoy it that much more, since it's coming from a fun, informal interpretation of it, although you guys put a lot of work into your research and display. Your Decoding Dedalus series especially is invaluable, as there's only so much you can glean from the annotations without wanting to bang your head against the wall. I just felt like I should drop you a line about it, as it's nice to see other people appreciating Joyce's writing and being so passionate about it. My boyfriend and I loved Ulysses, and it's from our constant dissection of it that made me want to write about it for my project. Thank you again for your content. You've gained an avid listener. I look forward to reading more soon. Kind regards, Eva.
And thank you so much. It really did put a smile on my face today.
It did. Yeah, we've been a bit down recently with gloomy weather and... all the usual crap.
All the usual crap, yeah. So it's always nice to hear that someone likes what you're doing. So thank you again. And if you feel like writing to us, you can do so via our email address, or we're also available on Twitter and Facebook. So what's another way they can support the podcast? Or what's a way they can support the podcast?
Well, they can send us cash, sweet, nourishing cash.
Digital cash.
Via the donation button on bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Mm-hmm. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a button that says donate. And we'd like to thank, this week,
Ellen Murphy and Roy Smith.
And Roy also sent a lovely email where he suggested, rather than getting that Foreigner song that was in our last episode... that you didn't hear, Dermot, because you don't edit the episodes. But he said, as an alternative to Foreigner, he suggested the song Love and Death by the Waterboys, and which he said is based on a Yeats poem. Mm. So if you want to know why that's pertinent, check out our previous episode, What is That Word Known to All Men?
Mm.
Let's jump into it today. We are in Proteus, the third episode of Ulysses. And we are on page 49 in the 1990 Vintage International Edition. We are almost done with Proteus, Dermot. Like, we're in striking distance. We should finish it probably sometime next year.
No, are you serious?
Yeah, just because we go in little bits and chunks. But we're almost done.
Okay.
How does that make you feel?
Happy.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're like dragging yourself over the finish line of a marathon?
Over the rocks of Sandy Mount.
Do you feel like one of those people whose like entire body gives out right at the finish line of the Ironman triathlon? You know the ones I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. No, like the marathon runners who hit the wall. But mm-hmm. You got to keep going.
You got to keep going. That's right. Well, this is on page 49 in my edition, and Dermot is going to read this passage.
He lay back at full stretch over the sharp rocks, cramming the scribbled note and pencil into a pocket, his hat tilted down on his eyes. That is Kevin Egan's movement I made, nodding for his nap, Sabbath sleep. Et vide Deus, et erant valde bona. Allo, bonjour, welcome as the flowers in May. Under its leaf he watched through peacock twittering lashes the southing sun. I am caught in this burning scene, Pan's hour, the faunal noon. Among gum-heavy serpent plants, milk-oozing fruits, where on the tawny waters leaves lie wide, pain is far. And no more turn aside and brood. His gaze brooded on his broad-toed boots, a book's cast-offs, Nebeneinander. He counted the creases of rooked leather wherein another's foot had nested warm. That foot that beat the ground in Tripudium, foot I dislove. But you were delighted when Esther Oswald's shoe went on you, girl I knew in Paris. Tiant quel petit pied, staunch friend, brother soul, wiles love that dare not speak its name. His arm, Cranley's arm, he now will leave me. And the blame? As I am, as I am. All or not at all.
All right, thank you so much, Dermot. What's on your mind, grapes?
Jesus. So, well, from the other episodes we've done and from some of the writing you've done on the blog, Kevin Egan was the Irish patriot, right? The nationalist mm-hmm. who was sad and lonely in Paris.
Mm-hmm. The wild goose.
Forgotten by the people he sacrificed his life trying to free.
Mm-hmm.
Nodding for his nap, Sabbath sleep, I guess it's Sunday, and he's just getting out of his head on absinthe. Couldn't tell you what the Latin is. Et vidit Deus, something with God. Allo, bonjour, he's running. Hello, good day in French. He's back in Paris. Let's see. Pan's hour. I guess that's noon, because he has the faunal noon. Couldn't tell you what milk-oozing fruits and serpent plants are. His gaze broadened in his broad-toed boots. So this is, he's back on Sandy Mount Strand, I think. Nebeneinander, we talked about before, and I have already forgotten about it because it's so obscure. Again, he's in sense perception, creases of rooked leather. And then he remembers a foot. So I'm guessing he remembers some girl's foot, Esther. Maybe a girl he knew in Paris. Again, memories of Paris flashing up. And then this odd mention of Oscar Wilde's love that they don't speak its name, which of course is homosexuality. Cranley's arm. So Cranley, if I remember also, he was a friend of his who there might be a gay undercurrent here. Mm-hmm. Or he suspects Cranley of having love for him or something going on there too. So that's about it. It's as much as I can pull out of it.
Did it make you remember why you drew that picture of Joyce in high heels?
No, it still doesn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm slowly going mad, so don't read too much into that.
We all are, Dermot. Mm-hmm. We all are. Okay, let's look at this first little bit here. I'll reread it. Even though you did such a wonderful job in your warm, dulcet tones. He lay back at full stretch over the sharp rocks, cramming the scribbled note and pencil into a pocket, his hat tilted down on his eyes. That is Kevin Egan's movement I made, nodding for his nap, Sabbath sleep. Et vidit Deus et erant valde bona. So, Stephen has finished composing his poem. Remember he's writing a poem?
Yes.
Yes. And he's kind of lying lazily on the rocks. And the way he's kind of tipped his hat down, he's, I think, remembering Kevin Egan having a nap. This is the first subtle hint that it's around noon. Now, I'm sure you remember back on page 42, there is a line that said, "Noon slumbers. Kevin Egan rolls his gunpowder cigarettes through fingers smeared with printer's ink. noon slumbers, right? So he's thinking maybe he's a little bit tired. He didn't sleep well last night because Haynes is waking up,
right,
screaming about Black Panthers or
dreams,
whatever.
Yeah.
Do you remember how this connects to the Odyssey?
Proteus and the shape-shifting waters, was it?
Yeah, Proteus was a shape-shifting sea god who trapped the Trojan war hero Menelaus on his island. Mm-hmm. And Menelaus had to hold him down as he proceeded through his various forms so that he could get the answer to his question.
Right.
Noon is the hour that the sea god Proteus would come ashore and nap amongst his seals, his flock of seals.
Mm.
And so Kevin Egan is meant to be the correspondent figure to Menelaus. So I think that the noon hour here creates that connection between Egan and Menelaus.
Okay.
If you want to hear us talk more about that, we did several episodes about Kevin Egan. So let's deal with this Latin. Et vidit Deus et erant valde bona. So this comes from Genesis 1:31, as in the book of Genesis in the Bible. And King James, in his translation, translated it thus.
And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day.
Right, so Stephen kind of chops us up a bit. Et vidit Deus, and God saw, et erant valde bona, and it was very good. Although sometimes that is translated as, it was exceedingly good.
That's from the Gospel according to Kipling.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's why it says it on the Mr. Kipling cakes box?
Yes, because for Americans who are not knowledgeable of the joys of Mr. Kipling, whenever we do move back to Ireland, I'm going to go on a Mr. Kipling's cakes rampage.
Well, make sure we have access to a dentist as
they
well.
They are as tiny as they are delicious. Yeah.
All right. Next. Allo, bonjour, welcome as the flowers in May. Under its leaf, he watched through peacock twittering lashes in the southing sun. I am caught in this burning scene, Pan's hour, the faunal noon, among gum-heavy serpent plants, milk-oozing fruits, where on the tawny waters leaves lie wide. Pain is far. So you guessed correctly. Pan's hour, as in the god Pan. Pan's hour is noon, which was thought to be the peak of activity for that particular god. The line, welcome as the flowers in May, is a reference to a song of the same name. I will put a link to a YouTube video of a period-style rendition of that song in our show notes, which the listeners can find at.
Is it awful? Does it sound like...
It sounds like this.
Thought
it's that
so.
Kind of
okay.
Singing.
Got it.
I thought about putting it as the little end snippet, but I have another idea for that. So this Faun's Hour and whatnot is an allusion to a poem by Stéphane Mallarmé, L'après-midi d'une faun, the afternoon of a faun. So this poem was very influential in its day. I think it's Mallarmé's probably best-known poetic work, so much so that Claude Debussy translated it into music, and I had found a version of the Boston Symphony Orchestra under the conduction of Leonard Bernstein playing that I really like. It's a symphonic poem for orchestra, I think it's described as. So we'll put that at the end and also in our show notes. Getting back to Stephen. Stephen plays with the similar imagery that's found in Mallarmé's poem. It kind of deals with, a faun or like Pan cavorting with nymphs in this very kind of drowsy, heavy, I would say kind of sultry afternoon. So the mention of nymphs in the poem, I think, could be a very, very subtle hint or subtle foreshadow of Molly/Calypso the nymph, who appears in the next episode, which is called Calypso.
Hmm.
And Pain is Far is also playing on themes from Mallarmé's poem. He really, I think, kind of digs into the idea of the intersection of pain and pleasure. But I think Stephen is actually just enjoying a moment of freedom and release from the pain that he seems to constantly feel.
Yep.
Emotional pain, if not physical. But in the next line, pain is near again, and no more turn aside and brood. So I feel like we probably mentioned this a bit in the previous episode, It's a line from a poem that was set to music called Who Goes with Fergus. It was written by W.B. Yeats. I believe it was for the Countess Kathleen, one of his plays. That's not super important. What is important is that this was mentioned back in Telemachus as a song that Stephen sang for his dying mother to help her ease her pain. The full line says, "And no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery." I think we mentioned love's bitter mystery last time. He goes, "From pain is far." He's kind of like lolling on these rocks, lusty as the god Pan in the faunal noon. And then right back in. Depression is a hell of a drug. Mm. He takes the idea of shoegazing literally, and he looks at his boots. It says here, "His gaze brooded on his broad-toed boots, a buck's cast-offs, Nebuchadnezzar. He counted the creases of wrecked leather wherein another's foot had nested warm, the foot that beat the ground in tripudium, foot I dislove." So Stephen dives right in. He decides to go ahead and turn aside and brood. And what is he brooding upon? So it says here, a buck's cast-offs. Any idea?
Oh, Mulligan's.
Yeah, he looks at his shoes, which we know he has borrowed from Buck Mulligan. Because back in Nestor, and we cover this in a blog post called A Daedalus Never Pays His Debts, mm-hmm. but I don't think we'd podcast it on this section. But in Nestor, Stephen recalls a list of his debts to various people, and one of which read, "Mulligan, £9, 3 pairs of socks, 1 pair of brogues, ties." What are brogues?
Shoes, Irish word for shoes.
Yeah. So Stephen is suddenly keenly and pointedly aware of his reliance on the snarky medical student for his material necessities, which would include his bed in the Martello Tower. Hmm. Though Stephen has decided to, you know, strike out on his own as of, you know, like 15 minutes ago in book time, mm-hmm. you know, it's thanks to Buck Mulligan, who mocks and disparages him, that he has a home at all.
What's tripudium?
Tripudium is a dance. I believe it's done in three. Mm-hmm. It's used in like Christian religious celebrations. I will also put a video of that in our episode notes. Yeah. I think the foot that beat the ground in tripudium, I imagine, is like these big kind of clodhopper feet, like stomping around and causing a ruckus and disturbing Stephen. Foot I dislove, right? That's Buck Mulligan's foot. Yeah, so he's borrowed these shoes from Buck Mulligan. A buck's cast-offs, Nebuchadnezzar, means side by side, right? So he's looking down his feet side by side. He counted the creases of wrecked leather wherein another's foot had nested warm. So, like, there's kind of an impression in them of someone else's shoes. Maybe they don't quite foot right. They don't quite fit right. And it's not just that it's someone else's foot. It's the foot of his hated rival, Buck Mulligan, who he is moments away from going to meet for a liquid lunch that Stephen will pay for at the ship with Haynes. So, next. "But you were delighted when Esther Oswald's shoe went on you. Girl I knew in Paris, tiens quel petit pied," which means, "My, what a small foot." So he's remembering a time in Paris where he must have been hanging out with his friends. They're all joking around. And she's saying, "Oh, you have such small feet. I bet you could put your feet in my shoes." Oh. He did, and they fit. And I think he got a little thrill out of this. I think he was into it.
I have a cousin who likes wearing. He won't miss any chance to put his feet into women's shoes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have kind of the opposite thing. My feet are small enough that any very tall male friends I have, I've found that I can put my foot with shoe on inside their shoe and wear their shoes. I think that's the implication here, is he's thinking like, "Oh, you know, I have these borrowed shoes on. Stupid Buck Mulligan." But he's like, "Oh, but you were delighted." It's not even implied. What am I saying? "You were delighted when." Like, he put her shoes on as a joke, and then it kind of wasn't a joke. Like, mm-hmm. he kind of liked it.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit of a blurring of gender lines there.
Okay, hence the drawing.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I knew I'd catch up with you there. So here's the rub. "Staunch friend, a brother's soul. Wild's love that dare not speak its name. His arm, Cranley's arm, he now will leave me. And the blame, as I am, all or not at all. So this is kind of the rest of our passage here that will also be the rest of our discussion today. So this tends, I know when I read this in a group, in a discussion group, this line tends to stand out because I think we can all probably guess what Wilde's love that dare not speak its name is, mm-hmm. right? It's a love between two men. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of background here. So Oscar Wilde, we know, is a poet and playwright, and Cranley is Stephen's erstwhile confidant from A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. You remembered his name, because we've talked about him before. The question here is, staunch friend, a brother's soul. Who is that? It could be Cranley, like Cranley appears right here, but he's just, Stephen's just spent a good little bit of time thinking about Mulligan, right? Mm. So it could be Mulligan or Cranley. Which one of them would have been more of a staunch friend or brother soul to Stephen? He has very fraught relationships with them. I think, Dermot, you're familiar with his issues with both Mulligan. Mm-hmm. He's been talking about them for years. But let's look at that phrase there, the love that dare not speak its name. So this is often attributed to Oscar Wilde, but it was actually written by Lord Alfred Douglas in an 1892 poem called Two Loves. Douglas is important here because he was Wilde's lover. They were involved in a love affair, which Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensberry, got wind of and strongly disapproved of, as that sort of, you know, a gay relationship wasn't really acceptable in that time and culture. And I think most people are probably aware of Wilde's trial for homosexuality. Mm-hmm. What I was surprised to learn while I was researching this was the reason those trials even happened, because the Marquess was quite happy to just put an end to this love affair and sweep it under the rug. Yep. It was deeply embarrassing for him, I think. Yep. But Wilde didn't like that, you know, Alfred Douglas's father intervened, and he sued the Marquess for libel, but the ensuing trials kind of backfired and resulted in Wilde's famous imprisonment.
So if he just let it slide, everyone would have forgotten.
In theory. Hmm. I mean, you know, who knows what would have happened, But two loves, and especially this phrase, the love that dare not speak its name, were used as evidence to condemn Wilde of homosexuality. And he eventually died in 1900, which is 4 years before this. Hmm. But even though he's died by the time of Ulysses, like, he's still, as today, pretty well known in Dublin, mm-hmm. but his aura in the city would have been, you know, much more powerful at that time, I think. And one random fun fact, I found this while I was reading in a book that was not about James Joyce or Ulysses, but I noticed that when Oscar Wilde first met Lord Alfred Douglas, Wilde was 38 and Douglas was 22, which are the ages of Leopold Bloom and Stephen Dedalus when they met on Bloom's Day in 1904. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that mentioned in an article or book about Ulysses. And that stood out to me. It's just kind of a coincidence, mm-hmm. I guess. Do you think it's a coincidence?
Who couldn't tell?
Yeah, I don't know either. No, I read that in the book The Victorians by, what's his name? A.N. Wilson, who didn't write about Joyce at all, so... Back on track. The love that dare not speak its name is sandwiched in here between these phrases, staunch friend, a brother's soul, and his arm, Cranley's arm. So again, Mulligan or Cranley, why not both? The theme of our show once again. So Mulligan kind of fades into Cranley and Stephen's memories. Like the border between the two of them is kind of blurry because they, as we'll see, they both kind of occupy the space of a friend that Stephen feels a bit betrayed by. Although Cranley is a very different figure in Stephen's life than Mulligan. So this is kind of, because we see this connection with Oscar Wilde then, staunch friend, a brother's soul, kind of gains the subtext. And, you know, definitely some readers start wondering how close was Stephen to Mulligan and to Cranley, and were they more than just friends? And the reason I got interested in this when I was first writing about it last year was when we were in Dublin in 2019, I was talking to a mutual friend of ours there, and he was telling me how, I can't remember if it was his girlfriend or someone else, I think it was his girlfriend, that it was her theory that Mulligan is gay, mm-hmm. and that he has feelings for Stephen. It kind of led down an interesting little garden path here. Okay. So let's talk about Oscar Wilde. In Telemachus, Oscar Wilde is mentioned by name twice, and both times on the lips of Buck Mulligan. So there's one scene where Stephen, who is looking generally pretty unkempt and unwashed throughout Ulysses, is peering into a broken mirror, and Buck Mulligan, this is on page 6 of my edition, Buck Mulligan quips,
"The rage of Caliban at not seeing his face in a mirror, if Wilde were only alive to see you."
So this is definitely a dig at Stephen's appearance. He's comparing him to Caliban. Do you know Caliban?
He was the sorcerer in The Tempest?
He was a monster in The Tempest.
Oh, okay.
Who, if my memory serves of The Tempest, sees himself in a mirror and doesn't recognize himself because he doesn't realize he's a monster. Hmm. And then he, you know, and kind of goes mad. This line, however, is inspired by the preface to Wilde's novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, in which the master quipper himself quips,
"The 19th century dislike of realism is the rage of Caliban seeing its own face in a glass. The 19th century dislike of romanticism is the rage of Caliban not seeing his own face in a glass."
That is, you know, written by Wilde, and so it's thought that because it appears in conjunction with "if only Wilde were alive to see you," that he's kind of mocking Stephen this way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very famous passage in Telemachus too, where Stephen kind of says, oh, you know, Irish art is the broken looking glass of a servant. And that's kind of Buck Mulligan's riposte there. Moving on to page 18 in the same episode, as Stephen and the boys are leaving the tower for their morning dip at the 40 foot, Haynes asks Stephen about his Shakespeare theory, which Mulligan had told him, you have to ask Stephen about this. He proves it by algebra. And Haynes wants to know more, so he asks Stephen, is it some kind of paradox? Which Mulligan naturally interrupts their conversation, and he says,
"Pooh, we have grown out of Wilde and paradoxes."
So, you know, if you're even passingly familiar with Oscar Wilde, some of his most famous witty quotes are paradoxical. Things like, "There is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that's not being talked about." It's a very kind of famous mm-hmm. style of Oscar Wilde. I think what Mulligan's getting at here is that he believes that Stephen has gotten a little too big for his britches with his kind of convoluted Shakespeare theory, which he, again, proves through algebra.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's saying, oh, Stephen's too fancy now for the simplicity of a mere paradox.
Mm.
Why tie Mulligan to Wilde? I will just say straight out, I don't think that Mulligan or Stephen is necessarily, like, secretly gay or anything like that. I don't think they're secretly into each other. I mean, the love life of either of them is barely discussed at all. But their friendship was once closer and more intimate than what we see in Telemachus. We kind of see the trailing ends of their friendship here.
Mm.
But clearly they were very close at one time. One reason that Mulligan's betrayals sting so much for Stephen is that they're coming from someone who was once a close and intimate friend. Stephen, I think, still probably, maybe even desperately, wants Mulligan's approval. He wants his friend to you know, love him and support him in some way. But rather than receiving this approval, Stephen has been replaced by Haynes, who, in Stephen's view, is a complete hack, but possesses the material wealth to be on par with Mulligan class-wise, and therefore Mulligan is impressed with him. And he kind of sees the shallowness of Mulligan.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen is so, and their close friendship is so easily set aside for this lame Oxford student. And so that Caliban dig is really about Stephen's low status and the low status of Irish artists. Because as I mentioned before, it's followed up by that cracked looking glass quip from Stephen. Another thing to consider too is the way that masculinity is portrayed in Ulysses. So Mulligan is this very traditionally masculine character. He's athletic, he's heroic, mm-hmm. he's dominant. He saved men from drowning.
Yep.
Right? He's boisterous and popular. These are all qualities, none of which Stephen embodies. So Stephen feels, maybe on some level too, that like Mulligan is this paragon of manhood mm-hmm. that Stephen also fails at, and he's feeling insecure as a result.
Yeah.
He's a little weak, with a crushed body of a snail or whatever it says in Nestor. He's weak, he's frightened, and he's dominated. And Mulligan is likely, as we think about this, we've thought about it mostly from Stephen's point of view. Mulligan is probably just as irritated with Stephen as Stephen is with him. Mulligan is at his wit's end with this, you know, gloomy,
scrawny weirdo in his home. He likes Haynes well enough, and Stephen's kind of, you know, putting a damper on this friend's visit. And Mulligan, as we shall see, he definitely has a pattern, I think, of using homophobic insults against men he doesn't respect. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that in a moment. So I think when he's kind of, you know, insulting Stephen's masculinity in that way as well. So Cranley's arm, this phrase too is very key. It appears twice in these first three episodes, once in Telemachus and once here in Proteus. It's on page 7 of Telemachus, where Mulligan says,
"God, Kinch, if you and I could only work together, we might do something for the island. Hellenize it."
And that is followed up then by, in Stephen's interior monologue, Cranley's arm. So we see Hellenize it too, this connection to the Greeks. There's an implication of homosexuality there, maybe in Mulligan's desire for Hellenization.
The Greeks invented gayness.
The Greeks invented gayness, yeah.
That's a Father Ted quote for those who aren't keeping up.
You know, and from, again, from Mulligan's own lips, later in Scylla and Charybdis, he sees Bloom and he refers to him as Greeker than the Greeks, which Bloom, you know, is portrayed as kind of a feminine man. Mm-hmm. Mulligan is mocking this other feminized man for his perceived homosexuality. Mm. As far as I know, I don't think Bloom goes. He's very into, like, women's behinds and sort of
ankles and all their bits. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has nothing to do with actual sexual practice. This is just Mulligan's way, I think, of cutting down men he sees as less or not properly masculine. He's kind of a prick. Yeah, so Cranley's arm, this phrase has appeared a couple times now. It might be important. As we said, Cranley was a major figure in Stephen's life and portrait. They were very close friends, but Stephen's relationship with Cranley was fraught in its own special way. It was Anna Karenina, the first line is that all happy families are the same, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own special way. Rather than being too frivolous and rude like Mulligan, Cranley is characterized as being far too austere and serious in temperament. Cranley and Stephen share a tense and passionate disagreement in the closing pages of Portrait over Stephen's defection from religion and ultimately from Ireland. Cranley was based in real life on John Francis Byrne, who was a friend of James Joyce's at the same stage in his life. Byrne and Joyce shared a very close and intimate relationship. And when I'm saying intimate, I mean emotionally intimate. I don't know about the physicality of any of these relationships, but they were emotionally intimate, I would say. Again, Byrne was more serious, he was more earnest in character than Joyce, and more devout in his Catholicism. The story is kind of recounted by Joyce's younger brother Stanislaus in his biography of his brother. Stanislaus wrote that Joyce and Byrne had a falling out around the time Joyce moved to Paris. So here's what happened. Byrne received a postcard from his friend James Joyce while Joyce was in Paris, and it was inscribed with a poem. He boasted to their mutual friend Vincent Cosgrave, who was the model for Lynch in Ulysses, that he knew Joyce better than anyone in Dublin, and it was proven by this incredibly personal message from Paris. And Cosgrave, who was definitely a prick for more reasons than this, he produced an identical postcard, but rather than containing a little bit of verse, it contained details about Joyce's sexual exploits in various Parisian brothels, which Byrne knew nothing about, because again, he was the kind of serious, earnest, very Catholic friend. Mm-hmm. Cosgrave was the Randy Horndog friend, and they got corresponding postcards.
Yeah.
This shocked Byrne. He was totally unaware of the side of Joyce. He was incredibly offended. And when Joyce returned from Paris, his absolute lack of repentance left their friendship irreparably damaged. And it was around that time that Joyce became friends with Oliver St. John Gogarty, aka the model for
Buck Mulligan.
Right. So I think this, you know, was definitely in the fabric of both novels, Portrait and Ulysses. Fun fact number two for this episode. John Francis Byrne later made his Dublin home at 7 Eccles Street.
That's the Bloom house?
That is Bloom's house, yeah.
Which is gone now?
Which is, yeah, the Mater Hospital is there. Mm.
But the Door of Which survives in the museum.
The Door of Which survives thanks to Patrick Kavanagh. Yep. All right. Stanislaus wrote in his biography called My Brother's Keeper.
Byrne's anger was not based on moral disapproval. He took it as a personal offense to him that there should be something concerning my brother that others knew and he did not know. My brother, too, had humored his friend's possessiveness so far that Byrne began to think that he had established rights of control over my brother's life. Manifestly, some kind of idol had fallen and was shattered.
Right. So that's Stanislaus's reading on it. And this interpretation was reflected in Joyce's unpublished novel, Stephen Hero. When I say novel, I mean manuscript that later was retooled and became Portrait. But in that version, which is quite different from Portrait, Stanislaus's counterpart, Maurice, warns Stephen that Cranley is trying to gain power over him. Mm-hmm. But Joyce, he ultimately wrote that out of Portrait, in which Stephen and Cranley's falling out is quite a bit more subtle. They ultimately part ways after debating Stephen's decision to accept exile and leave Ireland. And so they have this exchange at the end. So Stephen says,
I will not serve that in which I no longer believe, whether it call itself my home, my fatherland, or my church. I will try to express myself in some mode of life or art as freely as I can and as wholly as I can, using for my defence the only arms I allow myself to use, silence, exile, and cunning.
That's probably the most famous passage from that book. You see it quoted on lots of things. Mm. But then...
It's very Miltonian. It's Paradise Lost, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I will not serve, which becomes, in Ulysses, non servium, which is what Satan said when he fell from heaven. So, the next line reads,
Cranley seized his arm and steered him round. He laughed almost slyly and pressed Stephen's arm with an elder's affection.
So he's remembering Cranley's touch on his arm. Mm-hmm. So in Telemachus and Proteus, Stephen's kind of flashing back to this affectionate touch. Mm-hmm. He says in this passage we're looking at now, his arm, Cranley's arm, he now will leave me, and the blame, as I am, all or not at all. So Stephen, to me, is clearly associating Cranley's warm embrace of his arm at their last parting with Mulligan's kind of special mix of mockery and his weird kind of caretaking, where he takes him in and houses him, but he's kind of an ass about it. Mm-hmm. He is also realizing in this moment that since he's decided to not return, that his friendship with Mulligan is ending. Mm. They're not going to be friends after this. This is a falling out. And what he really wants is a friend to accept him as he is, all or not at all, as he says, which is a test that both Mulligan and Cranley have failed in different ways. Mm. Outgrowing wild then means that what he's really outgrowing are these intimate male relationships. These types of relationships are for youth only. Artistic exile means abandoning them entirely if Stephen is to grow and mature as an artist. And Stephen debates this point in Portrait with Cranley when they're discussing his exile. And Stephen says that he will risk being totally alone for the sake of his art. The end of their conversation in Proteus goes like this.
And not to have any one person, Cranley said, who would be more than a friend, more even than the noblest and truest friend a man ever had. His words seemed to have struck some deep chord in his own nature. Had he spoken to himself, or himself as he was or wished to be? Stephen watched his face for some moments in silence. A cold sadness was there. He had spoken of himself, of his loneliness, which he feared. Of whom are you speaking? Stephen asked at length. Cranley did not answer.
So when you hear that, what goes through your mind?
Oh, yeah, there's a certain gray zone there, all right, isn't there? Mm.
It's subtle.
Mm. People at this time would have to have been subtle. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were out in 1904, anything around, you know what happened to Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, it's not that long before, not just living memory, but like very recent memory.
Yeah, like you've got Tchaikovsky in Russia, very different country, but the same kind of matrix. You had to commit suicide rather than live with... You know, being outed as gay.
And Cranley is not comfortable being set aside. He's not ready to let their friendship end. Mm-hmm. Stephen sees exile as the only way forward, but Cranley just, like, to not have anyone in your life. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think that
that would be a pretty logical reaction. If your closest friend came to you and said, I must go to Paris and be an exile for my art.
Yeah.
How would you react?
Yeah, like get a grip on yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to have any friends?
Yeah.
Why? But this scene is sometimes referenced as a gay panic on Stephen's part, which I think there might be a little flash of surprise or confusion or discomfort even at most that flashes through Stephen's mind. But usually the way this is interpreted is that Cranley expresses this feeling for him and then Stephen panics. And then that's why Stephen abandoned Cranley as a friend.
Mm.
That there's all this surface stuff about religion and exile and that, but really it's because Cranley got too close. So in this interpretation, which I don't really... I've read and reread this passage, and I just don't feel that when I read it. I could be wrong. Please reach out if you think I am. But in this interpretation, this gay panic interpretation, Stephen's recurring thoughts of Cranley's arm are a mental shudder at that love that dare not speak its name. But for my part, I feel like it really does seem like there's something more than just platonic in Cranley's words, but I don't really see the panic on Stephen's end. If anything, his friend has just declared his love for him, and Stephen is kind of too naive to really understand the depth of Cranley's sadness at their parting. Because he's thinking, like, is that what he wants? Is that what he wishes was? And then he just kind of moves past it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, of whom are you speaking? Stephen asked at length, and Cranley did not answer. But, I mean, if you read the rest of Portrait 2, like, there's at least not openly any disavowal of Cranley. And really, when Stephen talks of Cranley, a lot of it is like, you know, he told me to pray for my mother. He, you know, was kind of pushing me back into the snares of Catholicism. It's much more from that angle.
Hmm.
And also the end pages of Portrait that follow this are in the form of a diary, so it would be Stephen just writing to himself, and I mean he could omit details from his own diary. Everything that Stephen says about Cranley after that, it just seems like it's mostly philosophical.
Yeah, he's not saying anything like abusive. He's,
yeah,
sounds clinical, like he's just running ideas through his head. He's not calling him a sodomite or anything, huge library of words people would have had at that
but
period.
That phrase Cranley's arm does appear alongside these Oscar Wilde references, which I think is what some people look towards.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's strong enough to call it
panic. He might not be sure.
Panic.
He might not be sure. He's like, is Cranley gay? Or whatever word he would have used, but he's not calling him...
Is he into me?
Yeah, what's going on here? Like, is it, like, where are we on the spectrum here with this, you know?
Yeah.
And like, there was a thing in, like, English boarding schools when the boys would be all in boarding school together in the 19th century, and one of the comments, it was very tough for the boys who were genuinely gay because they would get into these very intense relationships with other boys, and then they would all leave the school, and then one of the quotes was then they would grow beards and marry women, and so for a lot of the boys who were engaging in sexual activity in those schools, it was just a school thing. It was what we call today prison sex, and it meant nothing to the straight boys who were getting up to mischief. To the gay boys, it was horrible, because then they realized that these people that they had these deep love for were just using them as warm bodies.
I remember Yukio Mishima, who's a very controversial author, but who was gay, and he wrote a book about a semi-autobiographical book, and that's in Japanese culture, it's okay for young men to be very touchy-feely.
Yeah.
And he said at some point he realized that the boy that he was touching a lot didn't feel the same way back. It was just friendship.
Right.
Senator David Norris wrote about this, and we'll get into him in a moment, but he said growing up in this sort of, I think, public school system is the right way to describe it, but these kind of all-boys upper-class schools. So he said realizing that he was gay when he was young, he said that there was a lot of, like, sexual contact between men, or these young men, but he said that the boys who knew they were gay did not want to engage in it because it might be obvious that they were into it in a way that the other boys were just kind of
messing around.
Yeah, just messing around, or they were just horny and that's who was available. And he said, you know, that the boys who had the least homosexual sex were the boys who were actually gay.
Right.
Because they didn't want to risk being found out.
Hmm.
So
my sister, when she went to our college in Dublin in the late 80s, early 90s, one of her best friends there was gay, and she found, talking to him later, they were like reminiscing about the time, and he told her, "Oh yeah, I had affairs with this one," and he would name all these different guys in the group they were in, and Kara said, "For sake, John, you had more sex than I did, you know, with the straight guys." It was just bonk. But that was the late '80s, you know. My favorite uncle died in 2010, and he went to his grave in the closet. He was only out in his obituary in the Irish Times. So, but for people of his, he would have been in his mid-70s. So for a person of his generation, it was still, he wasn't going to be out, and he wasn't going to drag his relations in our small hometown, 50 miles south of Dublin, into that world. So he just decided to stay in the closet for his entire life. So it's complex, and you know, and as late as 1982, homosexuality was illegal in Ireland. Now nobody was ever sent to jail for it in that period, but it was still on the books. It was it was illegal.
So some of this we're going to get into in our last section. Right. There's one more bit I wanted to touch on here, and then we can
just
circle back.
Just to
this.
Stress that these things going through his mind, it looks from what I'm reading here, the passages we pulled, he's been very cautious and judicious in the language.
Do you mean Stephen
he's,
or Stephen, Cranley?
Stephen. Mm-hmm. Of like trying to like figure out what's going on, what's the range of behavior here. He's not using any like gross terminology. Mm-hmm. And he's been very calm about it.
All right.
So I don't get like gay panic or anything.
Okay.
That's not my amateur vibe.
Let's look back at this phrase, "We have grown out of wild," that Mulligan says to Haynes. So Stephen's youth, and I think the youth of many boys from that time, was crowded with intimate male relationships, but really very few relationships of any kind with women. Stephen's only relationships with women are either like familial, his mother and his sisters, and those have all grown distant. Mm-hmm. I mean, Emma Cleary, you can kind of put in, but she's barely in that book. Or they're purely sexual, like with sex workers, prostitutes. And this is a product of the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very conservative era. Gender segregation was kind of the rule of the day. And, you know, Stephen alludes to having a female friend in Paris, which I think would have been less restrictive than England, or a place very influenced by Victorian English culture, which would have been upper-class Dublin at that time, or the kind of the circles he was in, even if not upper-class himself. His schooling took place entirely in these all-boys schools, which we talked about just now. I don't think that Stephen spends all of his time with other men out of romantic or sexual interest. I think that was the only option he had in this very rigid conservative culture that he's casting off. You know, his trip to Paris didn't work out, but he's come back to Dublin. But he still, like, in his heart is rejecting this culture. Just because he couldn't afford to stay in Paris doesn't mean that he changed his idea about his principles that he had this big argument with Cranley about. I think if Stephen had lived in 2020, he could have had maybe some very rich friendships with women rather than just these kind of macho dudes that he knows in Dublin who mock and denigrate him, which mostly that place is taken up by Mulligan, Lynch to a certain degree, and these other kind of medical students we'll see later in the novel.
Right.
Which Bloom also doesn't really fit in. I think that was Joyce writing about how he himself didn't feel like he fit in. So much of Ulysses is about being an outsider and an outsider in your own culture. And I think that it's that kind of, I don't want to say gender identity or gender expression because that feels very loaded. But to be someone who's atypical of your own gender is hard in such a rigid culture. Mm-hmm. Stephen clearly desires touch. Right? As he was expressing just a few paragraphs back, "I'm quite alone here, sad too, touch me, touch me." So maybe it's possible that Stephen is repressing gay feelings for the entirety of two novels. I just think it's a lot more likely that Stephen is just so unable to make the types of connections that deep down he really needs, and that he's looking for another kind of feminized man, and that role will ultimately be filled by Leopold Bloom, whose friendship he also kind of rejects. He pushes Bloom away too.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, we've talked about gay culture in Ireland a little bit, gay culture of this period. We're talking about James Joyce. If only there was some expert who existed who knew lots about James Joyce and also what it's like to be a gay man in Ireland. Mm-hmm.
Oh, but who could that be?
I think we have a candidate.
Who would that be?
David Norris.
Okay, I wanted senator. You to say David Norris. Who's David Norris?
Irish politician. He's a senator. He ran for president a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Openly gay. And he's famous for challenging the Irish laws on homosexuality mm-hmm. in the European Court of Human Rights and winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry, I spoke over you.
That was 1992, mm-hmm. the ancient olden times of long, long ago.
Yeah, 28 years ago. He actually helped to overturn Ireland's anti-gay laws, the very same laws that were used to convict Oscar Wilde. David Norris had a hand in undoing. Mm-hmm. He was the first openly gay man elected to public office in Ireland, and he's also a Joyce Scholar. Mm-hmm. In 1994, the journal James Joyce Quarterly, which Blooms and Barnacle would not exist without, they printed an issue focusing entirely on queer issues, their connections to James Joyce, and they included an article by Norris, which is fantastic. And there will be a link to it in the further reading section, our show notes. There will also be a link to David Norris's TED Talk about overturning those anti-gay laws. So you should definitely go watch that if you're at all interested in, you know, any of these topics. So Senator Norris wrote that Joyce referred to Wilde's homosexuality as a, quote, unhappy mania. And Joyce mistakenly believed that the public school system in which he was educated created homosexuality in young men. This would kind of account for those intense feelings between young men in close quarters, like mm-hmm. Stephen and Cranley or Stephen and Mulligan, but that young men would outgrow these feelings once they reached manhood. Mm. So that was Joyce's personal view. Just going to throw out there, being gay is not a choice. Like, but this was Joyce's point of view on it, you know, a century ago. So do with that what you will. So of Cranley and Stephen's conversation at the end of Portrait, Norris wrote that the, quote, the function of this suggestion is to place Cranley in the position of adoring acolyte than to flesh out any sexual suggestions. So he's kind of saying, like, this is meant to show Cranley in that light as kind of an obsessive friend or follower that Stanislaus wrote about and Joyce mm-hmm. himself wrote about in an earlier draft, and that I don't think he sees any, you know, sexual connotation to it necessarily. Yes. Again, is in line with what Stanislaus wrote. And Senator Norris closes his article in James Joyce Quarterly, which I realize I didn't put the title in my notes, so I apologize, but it'll be in the show notes. He closes his article in James Joyce Quarterly by saying, quote, my personal belief is that homosexuality was a subject that scarcely engaged Joyce's attention at all, and of which he had little real knowledge. End quote. Mm. Thus spake Norris. Mm. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. No, I can see, like, the very flickering when he's talking about Cranley. And he's like, is he? And that doesn't mm-hmm. give it a second thought after that.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, too, like, there are definitely, like, queer readings of Ulysses. I've read a bunch of them when I was looking into this. By a bunch, I think maybe one or two. But I felt like I definitely saw things that were like, you know, I think it's a bit of a like a postmodernist take where, like, if I want to see Bloom and Stephen as being in a sexual relationship, then that is what Ulysses is, because that's how I want to read it. I guess that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong if you read this and you read deeper feelings into the characters in Ulysses. I think after rereading that scene in Portrait, I definitely see Cranley as having stronger than platonic feelings for Stephen. But, you know, based on what's actually in the text and from, you know, opinions from experts like David Norris, I don't think that's necessarily what Joyce intended. Mm-hmm. And I tend to agree personally with Senator Norris when he wrote in the same article, quote, attempts to impose a sexualization of Joyce's narrative in a book like Ulysses are likely to come unstuck. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that, like I said, there is a style of scholarship that wants to impose that kind of narrative on it. I don't think it's personally there. Really, what came to my mind again and again and again as I read this and thought about it and wrote about it, is that Joyce wrote about so many taboo subjects in Ulysses.
if I think if Joyce had wanted to portray a sexual relationship between men, I think he just would have done so.
Mm-hmm.
He was not afraid to be controversial. Yeah, do you have any thoughts?
No, I don't see. First of all, I have a right to read the text, and you do. If you would, let's just accept that. I also have a right to read your reading and go, I disagree with it.
Yeah.
And you can't have it both ways. You can't be like claiming like some supreme privilege. We all have the same privilege then to have our own personal readings, and we probably all do.
Yeah.
Like any two people have a slightly different reading of a book, you know, or a movie or any text. But it should be as grounded as possible in the text itself and not what you would want the author to have written.
Yeah, I didn't find those particular readings, which I think I really only came across one, maybe two. It's been a while since I did the research.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't find it particularly compelling.
Yeah.
It was interesting. It's fun to think about.
Yeah.
But I always want to come back to what's actually in the text.
Well, you end up like Stephen, thinking the Hamlet is like this mad Hamlet theory.
Yeah, you can prove by algebra that Bloom and Stephen, you know, we're into each other.
Yeah. You end up with like all these Da Vinci Code readings of history. It's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, that the human brain is incredibly good at seeing patterns, even mm-hmm. where there are none.
Yeah.
And when you take something like Ulysses that's so grand and enormous and is full of puzzles.
Yeah.
That you might start seeing puzzles that aren't really there. But you know what? What the hell? If, you know, that's the reading you want to have of Ulysses, it doesn't really bother me. I just don't really see the evidence for it there. On the other hand, if you have a Stephen Dedalus, Buck Mulligan slash fiction that you are dying to share, I'm very easy to find on social media. And if it's good, I'll read it on the podcast.
Wasn't that what David Norris said? He was, if that stuff is out there, I want to read it. Give it to me.
I don't know. That quote didn't make it into my notes, but Kelly Bryan's saying
all
that.
Right, well.
If you have written one, I want to read it. If you haven't written one, write one. And if it's good, I'll read it on the podcast.
Hmm.
Or maybe I'll make Dermot read it.
Okay. We'll put that behind the Patreon wall. You're going to have to pay for that.
Well, that would require us to have a Patreon. All right, any other thoughts before we head out?
No, that's all
right. All right. Well, we'll leave you with the musical stylings of the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
All right.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Here's some Smiri Debussy. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of three things to help support us. Number one, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. Two, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And three, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group, Blooms and Barnacles Podcast, on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com.
That's blooms, A-N-D, barnacles at gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.